This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We have a lot of work to do to restore, I think, everyone's faith in government and to recruit really talented people into the federal government to get back to doing the work that those agencies were really set up to do.
For decades, Republicans have been echoing the same mantra that government is not the solution, it's the problem. And for the most part, when the GOP is in power, this aphorism sadly rings all too true. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Ann Carlson, an environmental law professor and former head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, about her new book, Smog and Sunshine, the surprising story of how Los Angeles cleaned up its air. We discuss the sound governmental policies and practices that allowed Los Angelinos to breathe easy again. Talk about how private industry lacks sufficient motivation to tackle climate change, and get a glimpse into how today's law students regard government service. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ann Carlson. She is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA. And her new book is entitled Smog and Sunshine, the surprising story of how Los Angeles cleaned up its air. Ann, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
So in addition to being a law professor, you are the former acting administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and you're a longtime Los Angeles native. This book focuses on government and reducing smog, but it really drills down on your hometown.
Well, Los Angeles, of course, is synonymous with smog, and it was really synonymous with smog in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. I grew up in Southern California in Orange County in Fullerton, which had terrible air quality when I was a kid. I was born in 1960. And many people, I think, don't realize two things. One is just how bad the air used to be, and two, how successful we've been in cleaning it up. So many people continue to think that Los Angeles is a cesspool of pollution, and that's just not true. So one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was to tell the story of how Los Angeles cleaned up its air, how much cleaner the air is today than it used to be, but also really to celebrate government. I spent 3 years working in the Biden administration at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and I came to really appreciate just how extraordinary civil servants can be, and they were, at NHTSA, as it's called. And the story of the cleanup of Los Angeles air is centrally about the role that government played, with a lot of assistance from a lot of other players, in cleaning up Southern California's air. It couldn't have happened but for government.
Yes, you write, at the center of this book is government. It has become fashionable to trash government, to lament its inefficiencies, to assume that much of what government does could be done better by the private sector. In the case of cleaning up Southern California's air, those critiques are flat wrong. Without the government, the air very simply would remain polluted.
That's right. And that's largely because the private sector doesn't have an incentive. In fact, they have the opposite. To clean up what we call public goods, air is a public good, and all that means is that everybody can use it and you can't exclude anyone from it. So if one car manufacturer decided, well, we're going to install air pollution equipment on our vehicles, that's going to jack up the price of the car. And if our competitors don't do the same thing, they're just going to keep polluting. And so we don't have any incentive to do that. The incentive comes from government regulation or taxation, some role that the government plays in making manufacturers of automobiles stop the pollution that's coming out of their products.
So we've done plenty of pieces over the years focusing on this idea of the commons. And this is kind of what you're talking about with corporate America not really being as invested in the commons. Individually, people are, these people who work in corporations, but when a corporation has to prioritize its policies, it doesn't want to necessarily take that first plunge into the pool and do the right thing for the public good. Is that just an inherent problem with the capitalist system and trying to keep things like clean air and clean water, or are there ways that we can affect policy changes from the corporate space?
Well, there really is an economic incentive not to stop polluting, as long as your competitors aren't stopping polluting. So it would take a kind of upturning of the way in which corporations are incentivized to make profits. And that's not necessarily an evil thing. I'm not suggesting that it is. But they're not incentivized to clean up pollution. And in fact, as my book shows, there's ample evidence that the oil industry and car companies actually actively worked to stymie government in its attempt to regulate pollution that was coming out of cars.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about your personal experience working in government and negotiating with companies, oil companies, car companies. It seems like the answer is always government is trying to eliminate our ability to grow and create jobs. Does this dynamic take place behind closed doors?
Well, I would have to divide the oil industry from the auto manufacturers, in part because NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, where I headed the agency and also served as chief counsel, regulates automobiles. It doesn't regulate the oil industry. But of course, the oil industry isn't happy when cars are more fuel efficient, because they make more money if vehicles use more gasoline. And so the oil industry actually attacked me very publicly when I was nominated to head the agency by President Biden. And in fact, Senator Ted Cruz, who's the ranking member of the committee that was supposed to consider my nomination, actively opposed me as a radical environmentalist. And much of that came from his support from the oil industry. So I didn't negotiate with the oil industry. I didn't have anything to do with them. I didn't regulate them. But they do have an interest in having consumers use more gasoline. Auto manufacturers are different because they were directly regulated by us in more than one way, for fuel economy standards, that is to make cars more fuel efficient, and also for safety technology like automatic emergency braking. And I found the auto manufacturers to be pretty candid, both with the public and with us internally. I didn't find that there was a lot of hypocrisy. I do think that once Trump was elected president for the second time, the position of the auto industry changed. And it changed in a couple of ways. One, I think they decided they needed to play with this president rather than oppose him. And so a number of them gave him campaign contributions and contributions for his inauguration. But also part of the package of regulations and incentives that the Biden administration put forward worked together. So the Inflation Reduction Act provided incentives for battery manufacturing in the United States, for electric vehicle manufacturing in the United States, and for consumer incentives to purchase electric vehicles to make them more affordable. At the same time, the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration were issuing regulations to strengthen fuel economy and to cut greenhouse gases and other air pollution from vehicles. Those were supposed to really work hand in hand, the carrot and stick approach. Congress repealed the provisions in what was called the Inflation Reduction Act that incentivized a transition to electric vehicles. And when they did that, it made the auto industry then oppose strong regulations because they were really kind of working in concert. And so it's hard to actually unravel those things, but the industries were quite different, the oil industry and the auto manufacturers. That's not so true during the 1950s and 60s in California, when for the first time, automobiles are connected to the terrible pollution Los Angeles is suffering.
February morning, my car won't start today. I turn the key at 8:03, with the battery passed away on Saturday night. Automobile, 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 all around. Rats getting mad in the springtime, widows getting mad in the fall. I got married in high school, or I wouldn't have gotten married at all. I'd be driving my automobile, to drive my automobile, to drive my automobile, to drive it all around. Everybody said to the new groom, groom, what you gonna be? I said, I'm gonna be a symphony just as soon as I find a key to my automobile.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Ann Carlson. She is a professor of law at UCLA, and her new book is entitled Smog and Sunshine. So, Ann, you were talking about how the oil companies and the automotive industry were much more closely linked in the 50s and 60s. If you can give us a quick executive summary of the policies that led up to the terrible pollution that we saw in Los Angeles in the 70s, and then we can start talking about some of the policies that went into fixing the problem.
Well, one of the things that happened in Southern California, this is not news to anyone, is that it grew incredibly rapidly from 1920 well into the 21st century. And with people came cars. The cars started rolling off the Ford assembly line, and Los Angeles residents and Southern California residents purchased them in huge numbers, much bigger than the rest of the country, which is why the city became synonymous with car culture. But those cars had no smog control equipment on them. And for quite a while, no one thought that cars were the reason that we had such bad smog. That's in part because other cities around the country also experienced smog, but it was largely from the burning of coal to provide heat and electricity. And cities were successful in switching the kind of coal that was burned to a lower sulfur fuel and cleaning up their air. So that's one of the things that Los Angeles did very early on, is it focused on what we call stationary sources, sources that don't move, unlike cars and trucks. And other sources, another weird one for Southern California, is that almost everybody had an incinerator in their backyard that was used to burn garbage. And that garbage burning created a lot of pollution. Once we tackled those sources of pollution, our air didn't get cleaner. It got worse. And it was a scientist at Caltech named Ari Hagenschmidt who finally discovered that what was coming out of the tailpipes of cars when mixed with sunshine was creating ozone pollution in Southern California. The oil companies attacked Ari Hagenschmidt viciously, and the car companies just ignored him. They just ignored his science and acted as though it didn't exist and continued to deny that their products caused the terrible air pollution that Southern Californians were suffering. And then once they finally admitted it, they engaged in a conspiracy to keep pollution control equipment off the market. And in fact, were sued for civil conspiracy by the Johnson administration and ultimately settled a conspiracy case that had them stop the collusive behavior that they were engaged in to keep pollution control technology off the market.
And just focusing for a second on one particular particulate, lead is a fascinating history with how lead entered the supply chain, how it became an additive in gasoline. I always thought growing up in the 70s that when they came up with unleaded gasoline, it was this great innovation. But then I learned maybe 10 years ago that lead is not something naturally occurring in gasoline. Can you fill in that history real briefly? And then what was the impetus for creating this unleaded gasoline product that is now ubiquitous?
So the Ethyl Corporation was the biggest supplier of leaded gasoline, and they were the ones who added lead to gasoline in order to improve the performance of vehicles and quit engine knocking. There were other additives that could have been added, but lead turned out to work well, even though the Ethyl Corporation, General Motors, other players here knew that lead in large quantities was toxic. It was so toxic it could kill people at high exposure levels.
So was the Ethyl Corporation separate from General Motors? And then also General Motors owned DuPont at the time, right?
Yeah, General Motors owned part of the Ethyl Corporation. So lead gets added, and the president of Ethyl proclaims that it's not going to be a problem for human health because it's going to be emitted in such small parts that it won't matter. And that turns out to be wildly untrue. And there's a scientist, another scientist at Caltech, a man named Claire Patterson, who shows that the lead in the atmosphere is in extraordinarily high concentrations, and it's coming from gasoline and from the emissions coming out of the tailpipes of vehicles. It's so bad that the concentrations in the air in Southern California during the 1970s were 50 times higher than they are today. And lead levels in kids in the 1970s, which is when we first started monitoring lead levels, were 1,000% higher than the lead levels that we found in the kids in Flint, Michigan, who were exposed to lead through water pipe contamination. So we all grew up, any of us, anybody who grew up in the 60s and 70s, lost IQ points. The estimate is somewhere between 2 and 5 IQ points per person as a result of being exposed to lead. Not only that, but lead caused all sorts of behavioral problems. There are strong studies linking the violence, the criminal violence that occurred in the 1980s and 90s to lead exposure. It was a really, really noxious, terrible neurotoxin. And it took the Clean Air Act to get lead out of gasoline and to provide unleaded gasoline at every gas station in the country.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Ann Carlson. She's a professor of law at UCLA, and her new book is titled Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. So, Ann, as a law professor, I'm curious if you can, this isn't really something that you broach in the book, but I'm curious how your students view government service these days compared to the pre-Trump days, and if they have been soured by what they're seeing today, what that could mean for having effective government. The fire brigade is led by arsonists these days, so it's a self-perpetuating thing. Like, for decades, if you don't effectively govern, you can then say, see, government doesn't work. How are these younger minds that you help shape approaching this? Yeah, it's hard to generalize, but I'm just curious.
I think you have to separate the federal government from state government and from localities. And of course, California plays a very special role in environmental protection and has been one of the leaders in suing the Trump administration to try to invalidate a lot of the worst anti-environmental moves the administration has made. So many students go to work for the California Attorney General, the California Air Resources Board, which is our most powerful air pollution regulator. At the local level, we have the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which has a long history in fighting air pollution in Southern California. The city of Los Angeles has environmental lawyers. The city of Santa Monica has environmental lawyers. So the federal government, there's no question, is not a place that students interested in environmental protection want to go work right now. The Environmental Protection Agency has been gutted. The Department of Justice has been gutted. The U.S. Attorney's offices are being led by people who are committed to carrying out Donald Trump's campaign of retribution and also going very hard after immigrants and protesters, particularly here in Southern California. So it's not a welcoming place at this point for our law students. I have hope that the federal government will return to hands that care about environmental protection. And then there are a lot of opportunities and interesting ways for our students to be involved. And we have alums all over the state government. We had a lot in federal government. Many of them have left, really leading the charge to continue to clean up our air and to fight climate change.
Yes, I mean, even though these students will be graduating when the Trump administration hypothetically is no longer in power, the idea of government service was very much rooted in something safe and secure. You know, you might not get as much money as going to be a Wall Street lawyer or a corporate lawyer, try to make partner at a big law firm, but working for the government is important work and it's secure. You have a good pension, but that is a little bit thrown out the window with this disruptive administration.
I think that's right. I think the DOGE move to cut civil servants with no regard for whether those civil servants were providing important government service is a really, really destructive move. And I think that turning agencies against their own mission is another huge problem. So take the Environmental Protection Agency, which now views its role as deregulation, not protecting the environment. It's really to try to protect business. There are letters going out saying we're not going to enforce the law. There's a new statute that passed for the CAFE standards. Those are the fuel economy standards that I helped set that rolled penalties back to zero. Basically say, go ahead and violate the law. We're not going to enforce against you, and we have no power to now. You don't have to pay any penalties. So we have a lot of work to do to restore, I think, everyone's faith in government and to recruit really talented people into the federal government to get back to doing the work that those agencies were really set up to do.
People who are not familiar with CAFE standards, if you can give us an idea of how vital CAFE standards have been to the environmental movement, the impact that CAFE standards have and just eliminating them, how ominous that can be.
Let's go back to the 1970s when the statute that authorized these CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy standards, was passed. It was passed because we were in an oil crisis because of a shortage of supply and a cartel that had arisen in the Middle East. And Congress passed this law to reduce our reliance on foreign oil. So echoes of today, as we're seeing gas prices spike at the pump, it is true that we no longer are as reliant on Middle Eastern oil as we used to be, but it's also true that oil is a global market. So when there are shortages of oil around the globe, that puts pressure on U.S. gasoline prices as well. So one of the things the CAFE standards were designed to do is to make cars more fuel efficient. When you burn less fossil fuel, you put fewer pollutants into the air, conventional pollution and greenhouse gases. Transportation is the leading source of greenhouse gases in the United States. And so if you burn more fossil fuel, you're going to just keep pouring more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, causing the globe to warm. So it's a huge part of the strategy in conjunction with the Environmental Protection Agency, which also issues standards both to regulate conventional pollution and to regulate greenhouse gases. That's been eviscerated by the Trump administration.
Now, Mr. Day, the lottery I win, I ain't ever gonna ride no used car again. Now the neighbors come from near and far as we pull up in our brand new used car. I wish she just hit the gas and let out a cry. Tell them all they can kiss our asses goodbye.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Ann Carlson. She's a professor of law at UCLA, and her new book is titled Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air. So we've spoken about the great progress that has been made over the decades in Los Angeles, but if you can put that in context for us, comparing it to some other cities, and then maybe put the spotlight on some regions of the country that could use a Los Angeles facelift themselves.
Well, I should start by saying that what happened in Los Angeles benefited the rest of the country because Congress passed the Clean Air Act in 1970, and that act was extraordinarily powerful and successful in cleaning up pollution remarkably from vehicles. So vehicles today are 99.5% or more cleaner than they were in 1970. Removing lead from gasoline, that affected everybody around the country, not only around the country, but around the world, because the technology used to clean up vehicles, catalytic converters, couldn't operate with leaded gasoline. And that's what led to the introduction of unleaded gasoline. And ultimately, vehicles around the world were outfitted with catalytic technology. So the LA, and that was driven in large part because the air pollution in Los Angeles was so bad, but even more importantly, because Congress gave California special power under the Clean Air Act to issue its own pollution standards for vehicles, as long as they were stronger than the federal standards. And California used that power first in the mid-1970s to push for standards that could only be met by catalytic technology, and ultimately for all sorts of other changes in the composition of fuels, in things like evaporative emissions from gas pumps. So if you go to the gas station in Southern California, throughout California, there are these big kind of clunky rubber kind of outfitting that prevents emissions from evaporating into the air. All of that, those kinds of technologies have benefited the rest of the country. California really has been a leader and a pioneer. And once California adopts things that work, they tend to get adopted by the federal government and applied nationally. Los Angeles remains the most polluted city in terms of ozone pollution, but it's way better than it used to be. It's really, really important to stress just how much better. We used to have smog alerts, which were triggered by ozone pollution, well over half the year, sometimes 250 days a year. We haven't had a smog alert since 2003, but we do remain out of attainment with the federal ozone standard. And that's true for a lot of cities around the country. So Salt Lake City is having a lot of pollution problems. One of its problems is because the Great Salt Lake is drying up and it releases all this particulate matter that is really polluting the air, hugely challenging. Denver has had problems with ozone pollution. That's in part like Los Angeles because it's ringed by mountains, and so the air pollution hangs in the cities. The cities of the Northeast, so I have a good anecdote about one of my colleagues who was thinking about moving to Washington, D.C. and taking a job at Georgetown Law School. And he came to me at a young child at the time, and he said, you know, one of the reasons I want to move is because Los Angeles' air is so polluted. And I said, you know, the air is a lot cleaner than it used to be. And one of the things you could do is you could go online and you could put your address into these websites that show air monitoring at a very localized basis. And you could do that for where you're going to live in D.C. too. And it turned out that the air pollution in the house that he was thinking about moving to in D.C. was worse than the air quality in Los Angeles. So all of our cities have pollution problems that remain. We do need to continue the fight. And unfortunately for all of us, climate change is making that problem worse in two ways. One is with wildfires, and the other is because as temperatures increase, ozone pollution gets worse.
The book is Smog and Sunshine, The Surprising Story of How Los Angeles Cleaned Up Its Air by Professor Anne Carlson. Anne, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Sure, it was great to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Come what may, down crooked paths once more. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Galactic, John Prine, Pink Floyd, and Bruce Springsteen.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.